right. Well, here we are. To dream again. To dare again. To feel enjoyment and happiness again. Or for the first time. To realize this is living. Be inspired. To see your life as an exciting journey of discovery. With your host of the Inspire Possibility Show, Mark Sussman.
Hi, everybody. This is Mark Sussnow, and you are listening to the Inspire Possibility Show, the show that hopefully will inspire you to make a difference in your life, to inspire you to get out of the box and think about things you normally don't think about. And today, we're going to explore the world of nonprofits. Over 10% of Americans work in the nonprofit sector, and leadership gurus mostly ignore them. That is why authors and change agents, Vivian Hexter, Linda Hartley, principals of H2 Growth Strategies, decided to research nonprofit leadership by interviewing 50 top nonprofit change makers. They talked with CEOs of organizations such as the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, Ford Foundation, William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, Goodwill Industries International, Share Our Strength, Nature Conservancy, Skull Foundation, and PBS. And they're here to tell you what they discovered. Their book is called Big Impact, Insights and Stories from America's Nonprofit Leaders. We have today Linda Hartley will join us. She is one of the principals in H2 Growth, and she's also got quite a resume that I'm just going to tell you a little bit about. She held senior positions at Bard College, Columbia University, New School, and New York Public Library. She's taught as an adjunct faculty member at the NYU Heyman Center for Philanthropy. And what I like is that she co-chaired and produced a regional leadership summit held at Bethel Woods Center for the Arts. Now, probably for a lot of you, you might not know the significance of Bethel Woods, but I didn't either, but it was actually built on the site of the 1969 Woodstock Festival. So welcome to the Inspire Possibility Show, Linda Hartley.
Thank you very much, Mark. It's a pleasure to be here.
Good. And so you and Vivian Hexter have been quite busy exploring the worlds of the nonprofits. And so what are some of the distinctions with, I know some of the leaders in, let's say, corporate America, there's a big trend in mindful leadership and conscious leadership. And have you found that kind of interweaves into what you're discovering in the nonprofit world?
Yes, I'm glad you brought that up. One thing that really impressed us with many of the leaders and change makers we interviewed, all, you know, many of the 50, was how emotionally intelligent and self-aware they were, and how often, you know, we would ask questions like, what was the worst and best things that happened to you, and what did you learn from them? And Leon Botstein, I still read this over and over again because I find it very nourishing to hear what he said about that. He had a daughter who was killed by a hit-and-run driver at the age of 8 on the campus of Bard College when he first started as president. And he said that was, of course, the worst by far that ever happened to him, the worst thing that ever happened to him. But he said that it puts all other disappointments and failures in relief. What I learned from that is that one needs to find a way to rescue victory from the jaws of defeat, so to speak, rather than turning disappointment and tragedy into an excuse for feeling like a powerless victim. I try to recognize the unintended gift. That's what really impressed me, the unintended gift that comes from tragedy and failure. It's like a prize fight, he said. The key is having the ability to get up again after getting knocked down. He also said that the other important thing is that you have to be fully aware of the tenuousness of any plan or any notion that you can control. You can't control what happens, and you're constantly at the mercy of the unexpected. So he said that
be sure, Linda, to keep talking up. Linda, be sure to keep talking up.
All right. He said that bad things allow you to always balance the relative values that you cherish and cease being dependent on what other people think of you. He was not so concerned about that anymore, about what other people thought of him. You have to learn to be confident in the judgment that you make of what you think is right as opposed to the popular perception. And the right things may not always be the popular things. I find that a very inspiring piece of advice.
Mm-hmm. Right. You have to kind of have values and core principles and stick with them and not get swayed by popular opinion.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Is that kind of what you're saying?
Yes, yes. And, you know, to be able to get back up again after something like that is, I think, just really inspiring. I think it also puts in perspective a lot of other problems, right?
Absolutely.
You can make them go away if you think about what really could happen, what terrible things could happen.
Right. Definitely. Gives you perspective. I know that one very well. Perspective, and you realize that safety, life and health, that's the number one problem. Everything else is number two. But the first thing is, and I always remind myself to be grateful for my health because that's a gift.
Yes. Yes. As you mentioned health, quite a few of them also said when it comes to really what we call sharpening your leadership skills, that's what we call that principle number one, and building emotional intelligence and self-awareness is one aspect. Another is, as you said, and I think it's relevant to achieving life balance. Quite a few, again, and both men and women said how important that was and how important it was to have a healthy home life and a physical health because that made them better leaders, better managers. One said, the head of the San Francisco Foundation said that he really didn't think there was such a thing as life balance. It's just life. You bring all of yourself to everything you do.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I think I read that in one of the materials you sent me. I like that idea because so often, but I also talk about in the work I do, what I've noticed is people that really are passionate about their work, sometimes they don't have good work-life balance because they're so consumed by what they do. And, I mean, they love what they do. It isn't like they're just so passionate about it. I know one person that's a music producer. He loves that work, but his health has suffered. He doesn't exercise. But that's just he's so fulfilled in so many ways. But he's missing that one piece of getting the exercise in, but that is a trap for, especially for people that they're just so passionate and so committed to what they do, is they don't take time out. So how do you encourage your people that you work with, some of these leaders, to create that work-life balance? Can you hear me, Linda?
We didn't talk very much about that. We asked certain questions. They gave us their thoughts on it, and we moved from questions, personal questions, to professional questions, and then to public policy questions in the interviews. Another thing I think that's a healthy suggestion that quite a few of them spoke about was planning for the inevitable, that actually helped reduce stress. meaning succession planning for the most part. Even, you know, even when there was no plans to leave, to really think about that for the health of the organization. Aria Finger, a young, very young CEO, as a matter of fact, she's the I think in her early 30s and one of the oldest people at DoSomething.org. It's a group of 5.5 million young people now making positive change both online and offline. They're activating young people, and they say that they're activating young people in every U.S. area code and in 131 countries. They've clothed half of America's youth in homeless shelters. They've cleaned up 3.7 million cigarette butts from the streets. They've been mentors.
Wow.
Her boss was phenomenal, the founder, Nancy Lublin, who founded DoSomething.org. Aria Finger, the now current CEO, said that Nancy is one of those people who lifts up everyone. When Aria was 25 or 26, Nancy Lublin, the CEO of DoSomething.org at the time, said, took her out for a hot chocolate. And she told Aria, Nancy told Aria, that you're going to be the next CEO of DoSomething. I'm grooming you to be the next CEO. And she didn't believe her. Aria said, I don't even remember if I said no, or, but I thought no. But she was true to her word. Nancy has given me so much, she said, that that's the only reason I'm successful today is because of her. Now, what an amazing success story that is.
Right.
You know, really caring about, accepting the fact that it is inevitable. Either they carry you out, which is unfortunate for a lot of people because they are so passionate and they're not taking care of anything else. Or they, you know, they take a step back, give themselves, I think, some perspective on what's really important. And this to me sounds like a joyous experience, rather than something that is, fraught with, fear for the future or getting old or, you know. And she's doing, an amazing job there.
I'm curious now, what is Nancy doing? She turned it over to Aria, so what's she doing?
I have to check, but I believe that she's on to another organization, that she's created another organization. She moved on. But that's, she also... Nancy Lublin started Dress for Success. So she's a serial founder.
Right. Serial genius.
Yes.
Serial.
If you go on the DoSomething.org website, you'll see all the staff pictures are photographs of the staff when they were children. It's very sweet.
Yeah. Absolutely. So what are some of the other findings that you talk about a little bit about work-life balance inevitability, succession planning. What are other traits of great leaders in terms of, in the nonprofit world? You talked about developing emotional intelligence and mindfulness, and if you went into this, but a lot of leaders I've met that are, let's say, into conscious awareness or into meditation, like I go to this every year out here in San Francisco, they have a Wisdom 2.0, and they have a lot of people from heads, a lot of companies. I don't know if they're necessarily nonprofits, but I know that they had a LinkedIn. He's a meditator. He's been in meditation for years, has a very committed Zen practice. So many people are into this mindfulness meditation. Did you notice anything with the people you interviewed? Was that part of your questioning?
No, it wasn't part of the questioning, but some of them did offer that they did things for themselves like that, meditating, or exercising, focusing on being in the moment, breathing. So they did talk about things like that. You know, one said how important it was to be in the moment when it came to building a family. And he said Bill Ulfelder was from one of the heads of the Nature Conservancy, and he said if you wait to build your family time during spring breaks or sabbaticals, you've lost the opportunity to be deeply committed to your family. And he says that he wants to show up as a husband to his wife and a father to his daughter, in addition to showing up for work. And he realized that he needed to prioritize work less and focus on his family, because that would ultimately allow him to be a better leader and more successful at work.
Let me ask you, here's something I was thinking about. What was there one thing you found that surprised you? Hadn't really thought about.
Yeah, let me
for very long.
For a bit. You know, I guess yes, there is.
Okay.
It was a big thing. There was the fact that we conducted these interviews right after the presidential election. And so everyone wanted to talk. It was a paradigm-shifting moment. And
you mean this is after the last election?
Yes, in 2016, yes.
So a lot of people wanted to talk then.
yes.
A lot of people wanted to talk.
Sector. Yes.
Yes.
And, you know, what their role was going to be for the next 2 to 4 to 5 years, how this was going to affect what they were doing, their work. You know, some of them very, very directly. And what we learned was that there was a lot of good things happening on the planet. We gained an appreciation for how underreported and underacknowledged the contributions of the nonprofit sector are to society. And you know, we're hopeful that that those that read the book will see that we've uncovered some of the amazing change makers. You know, when we say social change, the word is used a lot. But really profound social change is about big moments in history that had profound consequences, like the Industrial Age or the women's movement or slavery or abolition, you know. So a lot of these change agents are sparking, you know, the next big wave of I think enlightened treatment of the planet and every living thing in it. So many of them were tackling very large problems like poverty or hunger. Or homeless, or affordable housing. So they are solving problems. They're not only finding the solutions, but also solving the problems that add up to, a very positive direction that I think is inspiring and that more people can learn from, and also use to make changes in their own communities.
Mm-hmm. So, what are some of the people that stand out?
Okay. If we're going to keep talking about change, I'm going to tell you about another principle, which was campaign on many fronts, meaning finding common ground, changing social norms. More and more now, advocacy organizations or change-making organizations that are using advocacy will use social science in public education. A lot of them talked about changing social norms. Here's Dan Gross, who until recently was president of the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence. He had a very personal connection to the cause. In 1997, his brother was shot in an attack on top of the Empire State Building. He ended up in a coma. He needed multiple brain surgeries. He's still recovering. At the same time, Dan's dear friend was killed by the same gunman back on the Empire State Building. He was a partner at a major advertising firm. And he took what he learned in marketing to begin found an organization called PAX. It was a youth gun safety nonprofit. They're famous for creating the Just Ask campaign, encouraging parents to ask where their children, you know, when their children play at neighbors' houses, to ask the parents if there are guns in the house, and a lot of people have guns in this country, if they are safely stored away, locked away. So that was a campaign that was actually very successful in changing social norms around gun safety. It's what he says, Dan Gross says, is that in politics you make change by changing social norms and creating an appreciation for the real risks, you know, like locked guns or unlocked guns in a home where your kids mm-hmm. are playing, create that indignation towards unsafe behavior and promote socially responsible behavior. He went on to be that president of the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence. And now I think a whole other generation is taking on that cause, which is very heartening. The Brady Center was
I
have to say. Yes. So I'm really delighted to see the young people taking this up. I think that their voices were what we're, you know, what we're missing, and these are the kids that have grown up with, you know, lockdowns
right.
at school. We didn't grow up that way, you know. We had other things. I had the Vietnam War, you know. But,
I know. I was just gonna say that it was the young people. That's what I was kind of feeling, that there hasn't been anything that has motivated young people since the Vietnam War. We were motivated because of We were, you know, for many reasons. I mean, as a very practical reason, you know, you'd end up having to fight a war that we didn't know about a war we shouldn't have been in. But even if we didn't have that awareness that we do now, it was huge. There were all these demonstrations, and that really that was profound. And I believe it did stop the war because of all the protests, and then the people actually refusing not to be inducted. And I know in my youth I defended a lot. I was a lawyer and I defended a lot of people refusing induction. It was a huge movement. But there hasn't been anything. The environment has been important, but people haven't been as motivated about the environment. They have to a certain extent, but not like the Vietnam War. And hopefully this gun thing will be what you just said. It would be like that Vietnam War, be something they could, that's very real, and it occurs every day. Because we used to get bombarded by news about the war, about how many people were killed. Well, that's what's happening now, and that is my hope too, that there's momentum and it keeps building, and eventually the political leaders have to listen, or they won't be in office.
Yes. Yes, and you mentioned in the introduction about Bethel Woods Center for the Arts. They were a client. The former site of the Woodstock Festival, it's now a 16,000-seat amphitheater, amazing concerts. There's a museum of the 60s and the Woodstock Festival, a really good museum of the 60s, the history of the 60s there. And we talked a lot about the fact that in the 60s there was so much violence and so much horror in so many ways, civil rights movement, all the violent protests. There were bombings in this country, a lot of them.
There were.
And there was the war, the Vietnam War. And out of this seems to have come, we think, you know, the baby boomers, who I think as a whole cohort were inspired to make a positive difference in the world. And that's, I think, still happening. And there was amazing art at that time as well that I think still people look back to and think it's holding up. I think in the way that some...
Well, it's amazing. I mean, Dylan...
Looks at.
Dylan won the Nobel Prize for Literature.
Yes, yes.
That was amazing. Mm-hmm. Totally amazing.
Yes. So I'm so pleased. I'm just so happy, really joyful of the young people and how articulate and smart they're being, and using, you know, in the best ways possible, all the technology and social media that they have at their fingertips, practically glued to them.
Yeah, fingertips, huh? Or you don't even need fingertips. You just need to look at it a certain way, right?
Right.
Yeah, I have a new iPhone 10, and you know, it recognizes your face. You know, I kind of with all the shows really talk about. And what we've kind of evolved into that naturally in terms of what inspires you, and what I'm hearing from you is that it's some of it is a social change that you're seeing right now that actually is somewhat organic. It seems that with the young people around gun rights and everything like that about gun control, and is there anything else that you can think of right now that what inspires you from the work you've been doing?
I'm very much involved in women's organizations. I have been since the 80s on various boards. NARAL, I was president of Women in Development. It's a professional organization. I've been on New York Women's Agenda board for 12 years, and now we've just started a new organization called POWHER, New York, POWHER. It's a coalition of 100 women's organizations in New York State working on women's economic equality. And we just passed, after 15 years, yes, 15 years, we just passed a little bit of pay equity legislation in Albany and also another helped shape a bill in New York City on the fact that now in New York City, employers can't ask about salary history because, you know...
They can't ask what, did you say?
About salary history. They can't ask about salary history when they're...
Salary history.
Interviewing, yes. Because, you know, women in particular, but not only women, have come from low-paying jobs. Why would they want to perpetuate that with their next job?
Exactly. Yeah, no, I know.
So, you know,
kind of like a catch-22, right?
Right.
It's a catch-22.
And also now in New York State, everyone is allowed to talk about their salaries at the workplace without fear of retribution or getting fired or punished. You can talk about your salary. So those are the two little things we've done recently.
Uh-huh.
So I'm very pleased about some of this progress
right.
as well.
Yeah. It's amazing how, when you think about it, at one time, you know, in this country, if you're a woman, you weren't able to vote, and if you were of color, you couldn't vote either.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's amazing how, and also with the marijuana laws, how, you know, in a lot of states now it's totally legal to smoke marijuana, where at one time you'd be charged with a felony.
Yes. Yes.
So we're running out of time. Yeah.
Yes.
We're running out of time. And I wanted to thank you for being on the show, the Inspire Possibility Show, and thank you and Vivian for the work that you're both doing and your commitment. Your life, it's really your life work and your commitment, and good luck on your book. Where can people get your book?
Amazon.com. And also through our website, h2growth.com.
And then the book, they can get it through that or on Amazon. So thanks again, Linda Hartley, for being on the Inspire Possibility Show, and to everyone out there. In the meantime, till next week when we have another amazing guest, journey on.
You've been listening to Inspire Possibility Show with Mark Susnow. To learn more about Mark Susnow, go to inspirepossibility.com and click on the contact button. Schedule a complimentary visit with Mark or email him at mark@inspirepossibility.com. Imagine the possibilities. Imagine the possibilities. Imagine the possibilities. Imagine the possibilities. Imagine.